Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Today on the show, we'll talk with a Palestinian student at the University of Wyoming who lives in dread of phone calls bearing bad news about his family from the war in Gaza.
I get terrified because it's not my parents who called, it's not my wife who called, it's someone else. So they might like bring sad news.
We check in with a University of Wyoming Ukrainian student who's ramped up her advocacy here in the States.
The scale of sexual violence in regard to Ukrainian women, children, and even men is only growing.
Money from federal spending packages is hitting the ground in Wyoming, and some people are noticing.
Yeah, I'm a cheerleader, but that's because we want that money. We need that money.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Giving Tuesday is coming up, a global day dedicated to the spirit of giving. Wyoming Public Radio will celebrate by announcing nonprofits and charities in Wyoming and beyond. You can honor your favorite charity. Just go online at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on the Giving Tuesday link, or call us on the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving. It's a great opportunity to honor charities and service organizations. Join us for Giving Tuesday, sponsored by the Wyoming Community Foundation.
Hello, I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
On Away With Words, we talk about language, about the secret histories of words.
And odd regional expressions.
And we explain those pesky rules of grammar in ways that make sense.
You'll also hear us disagree.
No, you won't.
Yes, you will.
No, you won't. But at least you'll get the story behind the story.
Get your words worth each week on Away With Words.
Join us Sunday afternoons at 3.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Turning Point USA, or TPUSA, is a college-based conservative organization. It and the Wyoming Freedom Caucus recently held a discussion on the University of Wyoming campus. 30 or so people gathered to discuss the Republican Party's priorities for the future. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger attended and spoke with state lawmakers, potential voters, and UW students.
It's very splintered right now, and lots of just little factions are fighting amongst each other, and some of them are a bit more moderate, some of them are a bit more America First, just lots of different camps. There's the Trump factor and how much he plays into it and the movement he's leading. And then you have the anti-Trump people. And it's just very splintered and divisive at the moment. But I see lots of hope in it for the future.
I think there's too many conservatives that are claiming to be libertarian or claiming to be, you know, live and let live, and you can't be on the line. If you're gonna pick a political side, you have to stand for it. You have to know what you stand for, and you have to come out when you're called, and you have to come represent.
I think at a state, I think Frank E. Thorne is a great chairman for our party. I know Roxy is a great chairwoman for our county party here in Albany County. But nationally, the party's real bad. It doesn't represent the grassroots at all. Trump's our guy. The platform needs to be entirely around him. The party needs to be totally rallying around him. All the candidates out there right now, everybody in Congress, they either need to get around Trump or get out.
I feel like conservatism in Wyoming is a lot weaker than it could be. Half of the Republicans voted with the Democrats with the bill, so I think that's very weak, and they could definitely improve upon that. We just need to focus on our unity, and we have to stand on principle as well.
I'm becoming more hopeful for it, like many of folks who are active in politics right now or who are newly active. I think that we have a lot of younger people who are starting to realize that we need to get involved. We need to start talking. And I think that I'm hopeful now.
It's really a grassroots movement here in Wyoming. The current state, I would say we need to gain a little bit more traction and keep making progress towards conservatism. So, little way to go yet.
I feel the current state is pretty good of conservatism in the Wyoming, except in our legislature. Our legislature, I mean, it's getting better and it's increased the last three elections, but I would like to see it better than what it is now.
Conservatism in Wyoming is quite good amongst the population. However, in the legislature, it's not. Well, I'm hoping that with our new speaker, that he's going to have a big influence on people.
Well, I feel much better about the Wyoming Republican Party than I do the National Republican Party. I think that they're going astray in a couple of areas, but I think that the grassroots conservatism is excellent in this state. I'm proud to be a representative here. Our legislature is far from being conservative at this point. And so, but there's been changes, and I'm hopeful that that'll continue to change to be a better representation of what the people of Wyoming are.
The respondents you just heard from in order of appearance were Austin Barner, a student, Lucy Holt, the social media coordinator for TPUSA and president of Students for Life, Gabe Saint, the president of UW's TPUSA, Nick Bogani, the chief of staff for UW's TPUSA, Ann Lucas of Conservative Coalition 307, and then Scott Smith, the representative of House District 5, Alan Slagle, representative House District 307, John Winter, representative of House District 28, and John Baer, the representative of House District 21, and the chairman of the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. President Biden's administration has been trying to influence conservatives in our state and in the region. Biden's administration officials have been visiting the West a lot recently to promote spending packages like the Inflation Reduction Act. They've already directed more than $50 billion to the region. But are residents of small towns noticing? Wyoming Public Radio's Will Waukee reports.
No matter where you are in Cheyenne, you're only a few minutes away from a project funded with new federal money. As you drive around, you'll see that an abandoned building was cleaned up, the airport added a jetway, and a highway intersection was redesigned. Outside the library, not everyone's heard of things like the Inflation Reduction Act. Judy Englehart has, but she says it's hard to tell where the money comes from.
We probably have money here, but nobody's putting up any signs for it, because nobody wants to say, yeah, we're using government money.
This is the most populous county in Wyoming, and Donald Trump carried it by about 28 points last election, with the message of limiting the federal government's reach. But when you ask Republicans like Kenny Stroud about federal spending on infrastructure, they're in favor of it.
I'm glad they're doing that. They probably need to do more of it, because I know, especially with the bridges, I know they're deteriorating.
Still, Stroud's not a fan of Joe Biden, and neither are many others.
Are we stealing from Peter to serve Paul? Is that how we're doing this?
If there's more money being spent in other places, we need more money spent at home.
But if the government continues to overspend, it's never going to right itself.
Biden carried about a fifth of the counties in the West in 2020, mostly in urban areas. Democratic officials say he needs to keep margins close in rural America. So his team is visiting. Video from the Interior Department shows a crane lifting a metal pole that will help plug an orphaned well. Nearly $5 billion are going toward restoring these pollution sites nationwide. And Secretary Deb Haaland said at a recent event in Wyoming that help will come no matter if you voted red or blue.
The Biden-Harris administration recognizes the significance of the West in meeting our goals for a more equitable, sustainable, and successful future.
Other officials like Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack have visited Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and other states. They're trying to get people excited by the laundry list of projects these laws fund.
We are really focusing on the opportunities for clean energy in rural and tribal communities.
Excited about our continued effort to connect folks in rural areas to high-speed internet and broadband.
It's a big bet for support ahead of the 2024 election, and it's unclear if this is paying off. One poll shows 7 in 10 Americans have heard little or nothing about the Inflation Reduction Act, and Biden's approval rate is under 40%. Emily G. with the think tank Center for American Progress says there needs to be better communication connecting projects to politics.
The more that Americans see this happening in their own communities and are beneficiaries of workforce training or good new jobs, the more these changes will resonate with people.
If you poll people about individual efforts, Biden does much better. Huge majorities approve of investments in manufacturing, job training, and lowering prescription drug costs. Terry Wykum is the mayor of Rawlins. A water crisis last year led to a boil advisory for about a week, so he's gotten more than $1 million in federal funding to help fix that, plus clean up pollution. He says part of his job is to find money wherever he can.
I held my hand up and I took the oath to ensure health, safety, and welfare. And some of these places are dangerous. And so we've asked for help on that.
Still, the Republican won't support Biden because of other policies like immigration. He's also worried about too much federal debt. But he'll still apply for grants because, he says, they're already paid for by the taxpayers.
Yeah, I'm a cheerleader. But that's because we want that money. We need that money. The problem is the ripple effect might buck you out of the canoe. You know, I don't know.
Right now, rural states like Wyoming are getting a good deal, enough to build a much nicer canoe. One report found that just the climate parts of the Inflation Reduction Act could get the state up to $7 billion, or about $12,000 per person. The question is, will the state use that cash? For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie in Cheyenne.
Up next, we hear from a University of Wyoming student whose family is in Gaza. This is Open Spaces.
This is Jennifer Hickson of The Moth. Moth shows feature eyewitness accounts of the most important or hilarious or moving stories in a person's life. We don't allow any sort of script on stage, so the stories have the excitement of a sporting event, but the intimacy of a tête-à-tête. The Moth is simple and satisfying, like a home-cooked meal for the ears. That's The Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Sunday afternoons at 2 on Wyoming Public Radio.
If you really want to know what's going on in this country ahead of the election next year, you've got to get away from the extremes and listen to the middle.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I'm calling you from Atlanta, Georgia.
On my new live national call-in show, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, we'll elevate the voices of Americans who need to be part of our national conversation.
Hi, Jan, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Join me every week for The Middle with Jeremy Hobson.
Beginning Thursday night, October 19th at 7 p.m. on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The war in Gaza might seem far away to many Wyomingites, but it's very personal to one member of Laramie's community. Abdalrahim Abu Warda is a Palestinian student at the University of Wyoming. He left behind a wife and three small children and now lives in terror of bad news from home. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down to hear his story.
I got the Fulbright scholarship after a long journey of applying for the scholarship, and I actually applied 5 times. Actually, like I made like some research about the international studies program here in Wyoming, and I found out that it's one of the best programs in the country. Before I came to Wyoming, I was in Ohio, and then I came to Wyoming, and now I consider Wyoming as my home. I love it so much. Especially Laramie, it's very friendly, very welcoming. The people are really generous, and they consider me as their brother.
I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about your life back in Gaza.
It's surrounded by struggle and difficulties. Like, we have a saying that, like, we get our breads covered with blood to express how hard it is. Like, unemployment is really high in Gaza. It's like 60%, especially among graduates. Like, and then you finish your degree and then you stay home. You do nothing. We didn't have like the basic things that you have here in the U.S. For example, like a stable internet connection, clean water. We suffer from like the lack of clean water and electricity. We only like for 15 or 17 years, we only had electricity for 6 hours a day.
Just, it sounds very punishing, and like, what do you think is behind that constant clamping down on the residents of Gaza?
Yeah, maybe, like, one of the reasons is because, like, Hamas is in control of the Gaza Strip, and they want to punish Gaza.
And that's considered a terrorist organization by many countries in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing is, like, this is also, like, insane. Like, if you want to punish Hamas, like, you shouldn't punish, like, 2 million people with Hamas. Because a lot of people in the Gaza Strip do not support Hamas. And a lot of them are independents. A lot of them like are liberals and open-minded, and they don't like follow or they are not affiliated to Hamas ideology. And it's really difficult like to punish like 2 million people just because of like a small group taking control of the whole country.
You know, you have 3 children. How old are they? And are they going to school? What's the what has been the school situation?
My oldest son, Faisal, he is 6 years old. He's in the first grade. He only went to school for 1 month and then the war happened. He's now like in home, like
they
actually not home, but like because they evacuated like our house. And then my second son, his name is Jawad. He's 3.5 years. He was in KG0. Like it's like a preparatory like school. And then I have Rita. She is 1.5 years. Mm. She was only like 2 or 3 months when I came to the U.S. And I miss her so much.
How are you staying in touch with your family?
It's really difficult these days because of the war. The internet like keeps fluctuating. For example, I haven't talked to them like in 2 days. Only this morning I talked to them. Like I lost like completely the internet connection. And I was really scared. You know what happened last night? Like, and this is like this happens with me like all the time. When someone from the same town calls me on Facebook or like, I get terrified because it's not my parents who called, it's not my wife who called, it's someone else. So they might like bring sad news. So I usually don't respond to these calls because I'm afraid. Like, I don't wanna like be heartbroken, like especially because like there is a time difference. So when they call in the morning, it's like the night here. So I don't wanna like respond while I am in my room alone. I wanna respond with someone around me because if like a mental breakdown happens or something happens to me, like someone would help me.
Yeah,
I was supposed like to finish my master's in December, but I couldn't work on my project. I only like started with the structure, the outline, and then I stopped. The war happened, and then I stopped. I couldn't do anything, and it's really difficult. And I contacted the Fulbright so that they can help me with that. They told me that they will try to extend my program for one more semester so that I can focus on that. So I'm working on that. Hopefully, it will work.
Can you tell me what it was like when the war broke out? How did you find out? Can you just tell me that story?
I was online, like browsing Facebook and stuff, and then like the 7th of October happened, and I was terrified.
Which is when Hamas, in a surprise attack, killed like 1,500 people or
Mm-hmm. I was like afraid when that happened because like we know like the Israeli response to such actions. But, you know, like sometimes you have that hope that maybe this time they will not do anything. Maybe this time, like they will like go for negotiation or peace talks or any all these stuff. But no, it didn't turn out this way. It was like brutal and I was afraid. And then like I think the fourth day, the Israeli army like sent leaflets to the people of the north.
Is that where your family is?
Yeah, my family lives in the north, mm-hmm. to ask them to evacuate to the south. I immediately told my wife and my parents to leave to the south. They refused in the beginning. They said that, no, it's still like, they always send these leaflets and they don't do anything, so we will stay. And then another week passed and things became like really dense. So I told my wife, even if my parents don't want to, you have to leave. Yeah, I go to my father-in-law's house and live with them.
Because they live in the south. Mm-hmm.
But like my wife's parents have relatives in the south. So yeah, my parents don't have any relatives in the south. So they stayed in the north till this moment. Yeah. And like 2 days ago, there was shelling and bombardment like a mile away from my parents' house. And I lost my... my cousin and his wife and their daughter, like their house was shelled up on their head.
And yeah. So their house was destroyed.
Yeah, yeah,
and
their house. Yeah, they were killed there. That was like a week ago. Mm. Yeah. So the situation now is my wife and kids, they are in the south, and my parents and siblings, all of them are in the north, and they are all of them living in the same house. Like I have 6 sisters and 1 brother. 5 of my sisters are married. But they evacuated to my parents' house because, like, it feels safer. And there's that thing that we do in Gaza. It's really sad that they say if we want to die, we should all die together. Mm. We shouldn't. No one should like endure the death and the remorse and sadness of losing someone.
Do you feel like that house is safe enough?
To some extent, yeah, because like the whole area is like very peaceful. They haven't like engaged in any kind of troubles or problems with anyone. They only care about like getting food to their kids, and that's it. But the bombardment happened now in every place. So like that's my parents' situation. They are in the middle of the north, in the middle of the ground invasion. The daily life is really, it's a struggle, it's a hustle. Because like there's lack of water, lack of food, lack of electricity, lack of medical supplies. People now are fighting for bread. Literally, they are queuing in very long lines, 200 or 300 people, like just to get like a bag of bread or something like that.
From what I understand, the diplomats have been saying, you know, we need to let some humanitarian aid in, like water and food and medical supplies, but that the Israelis are saying not until Hamas releases the hostages. Yeah, how's that completely being severed from, you know, any sort of aid?
It's really difficult, like, because now there is like a scarcity in almost every element. Food is getting really expensive. It's also like there is no water. Israel like bombed a lot of the water wells, water like sanitation plants. They bombed them.
Mm, they were targets.
We think that now they are trying to starve us. It's like starvation. I have seen pictures of my kids like before the war and now, and they are losing weight, and this is not a good sign. They are always hungry. They are they suffer from like dehydration. They have water, but it's like a very like a small amount of water. It's like half a liter a day, which is nothing.
No.
Yeah. And you know, like sometimes, that's my fear right now. And this might result to like kidney failure or something like that. And like if that happened, hospitals cannot accept like ordinary patients now. People with cancer, diabetes, they don't go to hospitals now. Because like hospitals cannot receive them. It's really difficult. Like hospitals now become like shelters, and like there is a lack of like medical supplies and electricity and water and everything.
Yeah. Is there any way for your wife and children to come to the United States and join you?
The thing is, like, I'm a Fulbrighter, mm-hmm. and they have a policy for Palestinians where we cannot bring our dependents to the United States. So I like that was my plan when I applied for the Fulbright. Once I come to the U.S., I will bring my wife and kids with me. But that was like the policy, so I couldn't bring them. Now I'm only waiting for the border to be open so that I can get them to Egypt or Turkey or any country just to escape the madness, and that's it. And then we can find a way to bring them to the U.S.
What is the status there? I saw that they were letting a few people through.
Only people with dual nationalities, and only like people like with foreign nationalities, non-Palestinian nationalities. That's it. Now, like the number of like injured people in Gaza are like 30,000 or 40,000 people, and the thing is, like in Gaza, if you are injured, I believe death is better than being injured in Gaza. You will have that suffering for the rest of your life. You might have like your like arm or leg amputated or something like that, and you will take this for long.
You know, I think that there's a lot of Wyomingites who are kind of thinking of this as something that's happening far away. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how it is that this conflict, you know, is right here in our communities, and what it is that Wyomingites can do to help.
A lot of people do not understand like the whole like conflict, like the 100 years conflict, and they only think that this only started in the 7th of October. We know like what happened in 7th of October is a tragedy. No one denies that, but like there is like a long history of like struggling, especially for the Palestinian people. So a lot of people need to understand the context, understand the history. And we have a problem here in the U.S. like with the mainstream media. They picked one side and they try to dehumanize the other side, which is really sad. I myself, I'm not asking the people to pick the Palestinian side. I'm Palestinian, but I don't want this. I just want people to be neutral and to see the truth. And that's it.
now that this is going on, what support have you had from the community?
A lot of support. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like, I wasn't expecting that to happen here in Wyoming, but it was like a tremendous support. All of my friends, my classmates, my even like the staff members, like they sent me emails, phone calls, tried to check on me and see if I'm doing good or not. And a lot of them like offered to help. A lot of them like invited me to go out. They tried to distract me from the social media and all the bad news or the sad news. Some of them like make me food and send it home.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. Like I'm really like thankful and grateful for the people of Wyoming, especially Laramie here.
I wonder if you have any advice for leaders on both sides and also like U.S. diplomats who are trying to figure this out just to get through this phase of this war.
My advice is similar to anyone's advice. Like, this should stop because it would not achieve anything except like killing and death and destruction. Even if you care so much about Israel and the state of Israel and the Jewish people, you have to stop this. Because now, like, the public opinion is shifting because of the atrocities and brutality that the Palestinians are witnessing in Gaza. What we have been seeing is, like, it's like some sort of, like, ethnic cleansing to the Gazans. They just want to get rid of them, and that's it. And this is, like, this is madness. And we are now in 2023. And there's like live cameras everywhere. This cannot be hidden. Like, this, like, everyone is seeing that. And this will like harm everyone in the region, not only Gazans. It will harm Israelis and everyone around. So if they want like things to be good, like, they should like put more pressure on Israel to finish this, to implement a ceasefire, and then move to like a peace process, like an actual peace process that grants Palestinians like an independent state with their sovereignty and self-determination. I am very positive that it will like generate peace in the coming years.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and helping us see, you know, a first-person perspective of what's going on. This has been so amazing.
It's my pleasure, and thank you so much for like amplifying my voice, the voice of the voiceless.
That was UW Fulbright Fellow and Palestinian Father Abdelrahim Ubuarda. Since our conversation, Abu Warda started a GoFundMe campaign to help his family get supplies and to escape the war. It made over $10,000 in just a few days, mostly from friends and colleagues here in Wyoming. In an email, he told me this gives him more reason to appreciate and love Wyoming.
Stay with us. Next, we'll check in on another international conflict, the Ukraine-Russian war. This is Open Spaces.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary, the host of the award-winning podcast Human Nature. And if you haven't heard, all 6 episodes of our latest season are available to binge right now. This season has a little bit of everything. Urban birding, a man pushing a peanut up a mountain with his nose, a dog rescue, and even a lobster who became a social media sensation.
Around mid-December, it just started taking off. The views were just piling up quickly. Went from 30,000 views to over 1 million views, and just kept climbing.
You can find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or our website, humannaturepodcast.org. That's Human Nature, one word, one N. And if you have a story to share, let us know. We are always on the lookout for new stories to tell, and we love hearing from you. So, happy trails, and I'll see you next season.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. As war rages in Ukraine, University of Wyoming student Anastasia Paraverte has been hard at work half a world away, doing what she can to help her homeland from the United States. Paraverte checks in with Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor on what she's been doing.
I think I first talked to you a year and a half ago when the war first started. How are you doing now that we're a year and a half later and you're here, you're so far from home? How are you holding up?
So I think we first talked during the first week of the full-scale Russian invasion. Since then, a lot has happened, a lot has changed, and obviously Ukrainian resilience persevered, and Ukrainian armed forces repelled so much of Russian aggression. And I traveled home last winter for the winter break. I'm going home this winter break. I booked my tickets. I'm super excited to go back home, spend time with my family, be in Kyiv, and, you know, just be around Ukrainians, because in the past year I came to a realization that it may be a little bit of extra emotional load to be the only Ukrainian in the community and to be the only one addressing all the questions, all the misinformation. I would expect people to get more informed as the time was passing. Unfortunately, that did not take place in many cases, and I still find myself in a lot of cases just addressing misinformation and trying to put things in places. Another big shift was I spent the summer in DC. I worked for a think tank and advanced my advocacy for Ukraine. That's what I keep on doing. So we've been obviously having a lot of community engagement here in Laramie. I've been working with media outside of Wyoming as well. Recently, there was material published with Insider and many other outlets. But I was happy to expand this advocacy to DC, spend some time there, and actually sense the political discussion around the war, how policymakers are reacting to that, what are the questions, demands, and, you know, key policy vectors that we need to be working on. So my summer in DC in this regard was really helpful and insightful.
And I want to ask about all of that. Can you tell me who you were working for and what you were sort of researching, what you were helping to research? Sure.
So I worked for, I had an internship, and I actually keep on doing this internship now remotely, for a DC-based policy think tank named New Lines Institute. The key project that I was a part of were actually related to Ukraine. So when the full-scale invasion broke out in February and we started witnessing the war crimes and the scale of atrocities, the pattern of the damage that Russia was causing, Ukrainian general prosecutor traveled to DC to brief American policymakers in that. And that's when the think tank that I happened to intern for first got in touch with the office of general prosecutor, and they started working on the big research that analyzed Russia's potential breaching of Geneva Convention and Russia's potential incitement of genocide. And during this summer, when we had more evidence, you know, as Russia was withdrawing and as Ukrainian armed forces were getting Russia out of our land, we witnessed, even in Kherson, we witnessed torture chambers, mass execution of civilian men, abduction of Ukrainian children, mass rape, application of sexual violence as a tactic of the war. So this summer, we published a report that actually discusses the escalating commission of genocide by Russian Federation.
This is obviously really horrifying stuff that you're dealing with. Is that difficult for you? You know, just knowing that all of this is happening in your homeland specifically, is that difficult to engage with?
It is. Undoubtedly it is. But what's important to realize that while we're researching all these topics, looking at them retrospectively, we also know that Russia doesn't slow down in its terrible wrongdoings, right? So even working with the Office of General Prosecutor, we know that with time on the occupied territories, the scale of sexual violence in regard to Ukrainian women, children, and even men is only growing. It just makes me more confident that I have to keep on working on that. I'm not spearheading, I'm not an author of the report, I'm just a small part of the team. My work was on the outreach. I mean, it is hard to deal with that, it is hard to read about it, but it would be harder to not do that.
While you were in DC, I know you also met with Senator Barrasso. How did that meeting go?
I met with Senator Barrasso back in July. The subject of the meeting was support for Ukraine. Senator Barrasso has been to Ukraine 7 times, if I'm not mistaken. He's been in Ukraine, interestingly, when Russia first invaded Ukraine in 2014. He was there on the ground as it happened. So hearing from him how that went and how he got back from Ukraine back in 2014 and tried to encourage support for Ukraine 9 years ago, or almost 10 years ago when it just started, that was interesting. I definitely appreciate all that his office does in support of Ukraine. Especially currently, his office is co-sponsoring the resolution on the condemnation of Russia's kids abduction. So Russia is abducting Ukrainian children. It's a massive mechanism of kidnapping Ukrainian children and transferring them forcibly to Russia. Some of them are being placed into filtration camps. Some of them are being placed into re-educational institutions. Their documents are being fabricated. Their names are being changed, all with the purpose of making it impossible to get them back into their families. Sometimes Russia even places Ukrainian kids in the orphanages, so Russian families adopt those kids. It's terrifying. The scale of this crime is mounting. So officially we have around 20,000 names of children who are confirmed to be abducted. But how many kids were abducted and we didn't know their names, we didn't know any information about them. Currently, there is a resolution in the Senate and House to condemn this, to make it clear for Russia it's going to be accountable for this crime. So Senator Barrasso is co-sponsoring that. I also met with his office just a couple of weeks ago, and his office made it clear for our delegation that it strongly stands with Ukraine, and it will continue support for Ukraine's defense against Russian aggression.
Is there anything else I didn't ask about that you think people should know about?
If I could leave everyone with one thought, that would be that the problem is Russia, not Ukraine. Cutting down support for Ukraine is not stopping the war. We can all agree that Russia is a source of the war. The reason the war started, the reason we witnessed all of those international either energy crisis or food crisis or just security, the reason for all that is Russia. Russia is a problem. Ukraine is a solution. In all we do, we have to make sure our focus is defeating Russia, not disadvantaging Ukraine.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Anna, thanks for talking with me today.
Sure.
And now, switching gears to head outdoors. Conservationists in Teton County are coming out in droves to fight a proposal to auction off a multi-million dollar chunk of land next to Grand Teton National Park. It's home to a critical wildlife migration corridor. Many are worried it will be sold to a developer that may turn the land into a luxury home destination. Jackson Hole Community Radio Station's Hannah Merzbach dives into the battle to try and keep this part of Wyoming wild.
At the crest of a small hill covered in sagebrush next to a cluster of leafless aspens, Beverly Boynton walks along a narrow dirt trail, a few miles from the sparsely populated town of Kelly, where she's lived for over 25 years.
You can see the Tetons from Mount Moran and all the way down to Glory Bowl.
She's among many residents in Teton County and across the state who want to see the Kelly parcel permanently protected. It's surrounded by Grand Teton National Park, the Grosvenor Range, and National Elk Refuge.
We're standing on Path of the Pronghorn right now. This is part of the migration route, not only for pronghorn, but mule deer, elk.
Those animals cross through the land to get to their summer ranges. It's also a core area for the near-threatened sage grouse, and it's valued at about $62 million. The Department of Interior has attempted to work with the state for more than a decade with no success to acquire the Kelly parcel and make it part of Grand Teton National Park. It's been able to secure the land around it, but not those 640 acres.
Stop the auction! Stop the auction!
Earlier in November, dozens of protesters took to Jackson Town Square, holding signs next to the lit-up arch of elk antlers.
Stop the auction!
Forest Service employee Henry Sollett held a sign saying Wyoming's worst idea. He says an auction is too risky in a place with global demand for real estate.
We don't need more homes to be built, to be purchased, and sit empty. That demand services for people we can't house in this town, all at the cost of the environment that we cherish here.
A land appraisal from last year suggested developers may be interested in that it could hold up to 18 homes on 35-acre lots. And there's a benefit to Wyoming if the state trust land is sold through auction. Any profit it makes will go to public schools.
I value education. I want this funding to like pay for our schools and our public schools. But at the same time, at what cost, and especially the cost of this parcel.
At a public meeting a few days later at the Teton County Library, people spilled into the hallways. Chip Jenkins, the superintendent of Grand Teton National Park, attended.
We are really concerned about inappropriate development.
Dressed in his emerald green ranger uniform, he shared how recreators, hunters, and wildlife all use the land.
They care about deer. There are parts of the deer herd from the Wind River Reservation that goes through the Kelly parcel, where they come here to the valley to get fat, to head back for the winter.
He said the other nearby parcels acquired by the Park Service in recent years have also been able to generate revenue for schools. And he's ready to work with the state legislature to preserve the land if they're willing.
Together we have done this before. Together we can do this again. We look forward to working to make that happen.
But first, an executive board made up of top state officials will ultimately have the last word on the auction at an early December meeting. And it may not even have the votes to move forward with the plan. Three out of the five members, like Secretary of State Chuck Gray, say they have concerns.
This is a priceless piece of property. And I just think it's the wrong move for the people of the state of Wyoming for this to be sold.
The land manager in charge of the proposed sale has also said not many people are supporting sending it to auction. But residents still have time to send their thoughts on the future of the lot to the Office of State Lands and Investments through the start of December.
I emailed about 50 friends to remind them that they need to comment.
Back on the Kelly parcel, Beverly Boynton points her binoculars to zoom in on two soaring birds flying overhead.
To plunk a development in the middle of the vast public lands, that would be such a scar and such a wrong move.
She says she can only imagine what the area looks like other times of the year, with pronghorn, elk, and mule deer pouring out of the surrounding hills and sage grouse finding shelter in the brush. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
As cooler weather arrives, we take a look at a few things that have been spreading in water bodies in the state. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hi, Daryl Brogdon here, host of the Retro Cocktail Hour, inviting you to join me for the music that's always served up shaken, not stirred. Whether it's TV crime jazz or tiki tunes, space age bachelor pad music, swinging soundtracks, or other incredibly strange music, it's on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
This time on the Modern West. Ariel Lavery's parents are forced to flee as Boulder's martial fire bears down on their beloved home.
Yep, everything. The fire was so hot that all this stuff just...
It just crumples?
It just crumbled and exploded.
Wow. And
the Winter Fire. It's part one of our new series, The Burn Scar. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadalska. You've probably been driving around the state in the summer and have seen those watercraft check stations by lakes and rivers. If you have a watercraft, you've got to stop. The reason why? Invasive aquatic species. This is part of Wyoming's effort to stop invasive species in our waters. And they've done a pretty good job. But one species has snuck its way in. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, it was recently discovered in an Albany County lake in a really unique way.
So I'm going to go down to the shore's edge.
On a sunny October day, Jenny Loveridge walks in her swimsuit down to Allsop Lake. It's not much bigger than a pond in the middle of a prairie in Albany County. Loveridge is gearing up to snorkel. She gets her flippers wet and slips them on. The water is cold, 48 degrees. Loveridge lowers into the water. You can feel the coldness through her breathing. Loveridge is a scientist that's lived in Laramie since 2004. She's snorkeled just about every body of water within 200 miles.
Because I love the waters here. This is one of the reasons I live here, is to be able to enjoy the lakes and the reservoirs.
And this summer, when she was snorkeling in Alsop Lake, she saw something new on the plants.
Oh, they're everywhere. Just little black dots. I mean, they're tiny.
New Zealand mud snails, an invasive aquatic species. They're the size of a grain of rice with a swirly tan or dark-colored shell.
I was just like, oh, this is, can't be good.
Like, when you say everywhere, like thousands or?
Oh, millions.
So she called up the Game and Fish.
My name's Josh Leonard. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
Leonard says mud snails do come from New Zealand, but were first found in the U.S. in Idaho's Snake River in the late 80s. A few years later, they were found in Wyoming.
Just like any invasive species, they outcompete those native species.
They can wreak havoc on fish by overtaking the habitat. So the native species that fish would normally eat start to decline. There can be 300,000 mud snails per square meter. And they're asexual, so it only takes one for them to multiply. And they also do this really weird and rare thing when fish eat them.
The opening of their shell, they can fully close that off. So they're able to basically survive the digestive tract of fish.
The fish use energy to eat them, but don't get any nutritional value. Leonard says prevention is key. Once they're in a body of water, it's hard to get rid of them. One of his main concerns is that they've possibly lived undiscovered in Alsop Lake for a couple of years.
Obviously, that means that there could have been a likelihood that they've been moved already to other waters.
So far, Game and Fish hasn't discovered them in other nearby lakes, but mud snails like to catch a free ride to the next body of water by latching onto things like snorkeling flippers, boats, or fishing waders, which Nicholas Gindelis uses when he fly fishes at Alsop Lake. He studies chemical engineering at the University of Wyoming.
I probably shouldn't be here fishing. I should be studying, but it's okay.
He comes out pretty regularly because, in theory, it's good trout fishing.
Well, it is if you're not me, I guess. I don't know if I'm not that great or what.
But Gindelis looks the part. He's got a scraggly beard, a ball cap that literally has a fish on it, and some long rubber waders. New Zealand mud snails weren't on his mind.
I had no idea that was a thing, if I'm being honest.
He says normally he just dries his waders, but doesn't clean them. And that's how invasive species can spread. Now that he knows...
Well, I guess I'll clean my waders so I don't spread it, because I'll probably be fishing the North Platte this weekend.
But he might be in the clear this time. Jenny Loveridge, the snorkeler, finishes her icy cold swim.
I think they might be hibernating because I didn't see any.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe they're in the bottom or something.
Which Game and Fish says is actually possible.
That was cold.
When Loveridge gets home, she's going to bleach her flippers and goggles to clean them, just in case. Another way to clean your gear? Dry it for 10 days or freeze it overnight. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Albany County.
Aquatic invasive species aren't the only things that have been infecting water bodies in our region. Harmful algal blooms are a major problem, and detecting them can be complicated. But using the power of satellites, researchers in Idaho have developed a tool that could make detection more efficient, not just there, but across the West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports.
Tyler King is a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He hops into a truck at the agency's Boise headquarters. The destination is Lake Lowell, a reservoir some 20 miles west.
Lake Lowell, as is common with many other water bodies in the western United States, grows an awful lot of plant matter.
It can also grow cyanobacteria, one of Earth's oldest organisms and a key source of our atmosphere's oxygen. But they can produce toxins harmful to humans and other animals and are one type of algae that can cause harmful algal blooms, or HABs. Much monitoring is done by water managers and members of the public, resource-intensive work with limited reach, thus the interest in satellites.
Basically, for the past 50 years, there have been satellites orbiting the planet, basically taking Earth selfies.
Some can ID cyanobacteria in blooms in the ocean and other large water bodies, but at a resolution that doesn't work well with the narrow, snaking arms of some Idaho lakes and reservoirs. Others with finer resolution can't make those IDs, but they can identify chlorophyll, suggesting cyanobacteria and at certain concentrations a bloom. King's team found some 17 methods for extracting that information from satellite images.
None of them worked particularly well just by themselves, so we built an ensemble out of all of them.
And that proved pretty effective at showing where concentrations could be dangerous. High over the other side of the Earth, a speeding satellite is on an intercept course with the reservoir. It's one of the European Space Agency's Sentinel-2 polar orbiting satellites, whose images form the core of the monitoring effort.
We want to be on the water body at the same time as that satellite image is collected.
At a boat launch, King's colleagues Rob Florence and John Karakaburu are slowly backing a simple aluminum boat into the water. Before the boat gets underway, troubling signs are already clear.
You can see these clumps of algae here. They look like colonial microcystis to me, but I'm not a phycologist. But it definitely looks like a cyanobacteria.
At the first stop, Rob and his colleagues break out the gear.
And this is a water quality sonde.
That will capture temperature, pH, and other water quality data. They also gather water for testing and churn it for uniform sampling. Here's King.
And after the fact, we will take the field data and we'll match it up with the satellite-based products to quantify how accurate they are.
That will make the tool even more reliable. One task remains to finish the first stop, snapping a photo with a highly specialized camera.
And right now, there's a cloud in the way.
Every 5 or so days, updated maps are uploaded to the public web application. Some Idaho water managers are intrigued by its potential to save time and resources monitoring. King says the tool is currently calibrated for Idaho water bodies, but with additional work, it could be used much more broadly. It's already being used elsewhere in the West.
It's really been a game changer these last few years.
That's Kurt Carpenter, a fellow survey researcher based in Portland.
Having the application calibrated for more areas, you know, could be helpful, but there's really no reason to believe that the algorithm that was developed for Idaho here, that it wouldn't hold in other places. I mean, it seems to be working beautifully in Oregon.
When planning field work, he says it allows them to more efficiently target sampling sites. Back at the boat, the sun is starting to peek through. John readies the camera and Tyler is set to take notes.
We're going to have a short window here, shall we?
Let's do it.
John snags a few more images.
And that's everything.
The crew stows the gear, and Rob steers the boat to the next site. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. A huge thanks to Ivy Engel, our producer, digital producer, and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.